This is Richard Verone, and I'm conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Douglas F. Shivers. Today is October 4th, 2002. I'm on the campus of Texas Tech University in Lubbock, Texas. And Mr. Shivers, I take it you are in Little Rock?
Correct.
In Little Rock, Arkansas?
Correct. Okay.
Very good, very good. Sir, I'd like to start with basically some biographical information. Can you tell us where you were born and where you grew up?
Okay, I was born in Little Rock, Arkansas, February 24, 1949.
Okay.
Lived here until I was 13. My mother then remarried. Her first husband had died in World War II and in basic training, actually. He was 34 when I drafted him. And we moved. She remarried and moved to El Dorado. And we grew up down there. I finished high school in 1967, attended Southern State University, which was called Southern State then, now South Arkansas University, I believe,
mm-hmm.
for one semester. Joined the Army in January of 1968.
Okay. So you said your father who died, he was drafted for World War II?
No. Actually, that's my mother's first husband had died in World War II. She had married my father shortly thereafter.
Okay.
It had not worked out, and they'd gotten divorced.
Okay. All right. So what I'm after is, what kind of military exposure did you have as a child?
My stepfather that came to my life when I was 13 was a World War II veteran. He had a Purple Heart. He'd been in the 309th, I think, or 306th Coastal Artillery from Arkansas. The entire National Guard unit, the entire unit went to Alaska.
Wow.
Where they spent 3 years basically fighting Japanese for a year and a half and just stuck there for a year and a half after Midway. Things kind of fell off up there.
Okay.
But he was hurt during one of the bombing attacks there. He did get a – no, it wasn't during a bomb attack. He was in actually – there was a small battle on the island, and he actually got cut by a Japanese bayonet. The man was shot dead by somebody else.
Wow. Wow. Okay. So did he tell you about these stories?
He told me some. It wasn't something I remembered a lot at the time, of course, being a stepchild, and, you know, things aren't always exactly smooth sometimes when you're growing up like that. I was already 13.
Right.
I didn't really pay as much attention to that as I did after I'd been in our service myself.
Okay.
And I was involved in scouting a lot. I was an Eagle Scout, for example, and I went all through the scouting and
the Malay,
which is a Masonic thing also.
Okay. Okay. So you had exposure to the Boy Scouts. Your stepfather had served in the military, and you went through high school. And in high school, what were the years here when you were in high school?
I graduated. Well, it was 65. I was a sophomore, 66 junior, and 67 is when I graduated.
Okay.
Mildred High School.
By the time you graduated, the United States was heavily involved in the...
Oh, yes. Well, yeah, I even debated on the high school debating team. We debated about the presence in Southeast Asia, in fact.
Really? Interesting. What did you think of the war at that time when you were in high school?
Well, you know, having grown up on John Wayne, you don't really know what war is about or what the military is really like until you get out there and do it. Then you realize you probably should have stayed home. But that's a young man's, I guess, whatever, stupidity, perhaps.
Yeah.
It was more of an academic thing when I was in school. You know, looked at it, I always... Well, just marveled at everything that was going on, but I didn't really know that much about it until I actually joined, kind of almost in a little fit of rage or complaints about what college was costing. So I joined the Army. I was going to show him,
okay.
Which I guess I did in my own, you know, stupid way.
Right. Well, let's talk about that. When you got out of high school, you went to one semester of college, and you joined then.
They joined then after one semester at Southern State, which is now South Arkansas University in Magnolia, Arkansas. I joined and. Like January 28th, I think, of 1968, which was not a good time to join. It was the winter, and I went through basic at Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri then.
Oh, wow.
Which was very cold.
Must have been very cold there.
It was very interesting, yes.
Okay. And so you volunteered, and you did this, I guess you wanted to do this in one cell for your own self, but also for your dad, to get back to your stepfather? Or?
I think most of just my own innate curiosity as a young man growing up during the war. Kind of thought, you know, maybe I should do this, perhaps. Kind of almost a corny, patriotic type thing, as well as being fed up. Part of that just being 18 and being a young man also.
Right. Okay. And why did you choose the Army?
I looked at several of them. I just had always had an affinity for the Army. I talked to recruiters several times and looked at the various programs they had, and I finally picked this particular area out in ASA, which is the Army Security Agency. It looked kind of like a romantic spy type situation or something, which was far from that. But at the time, I didn't know.
Right. Okay. So you go to Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri.
Correct.
And this is 1968. What was your basic training like? How could you describe it in general?
It was fairly tough, and it was just endless days of work. It seemed like when you had 15 minutes, it was a lot of time. We got up early. We marched everywhere. It snowed a lot. This was about the time that Tet is 68 hit in Vietnam, which was the big one, which politically kind of turned the citizenry against our effort over there, I guess, even though I think we won militarily on the ground quite handily. It was a surprise.
Right.
Overnight, basic training went from worse to went from bad to worse.
They
cranked down. We were honored with being one of the first units to have a five-day bivouac instead of 2 days where you go out and live in the woods, basically.
Okay.
It snowed four of those 5 days.
Wow.
I mean, it was a nightmare. It's the one time in my life I think I went 1 week without a bowel movement because I ate so little and worked so much there was nothing left over.
Wow.
To give you some graphic input there.
Yeah, well, that's fine. What was your most challenging aspect of that basic training?
I think that period when we were out and it snowed on us so much and we were walking like 6 miles to the rifle range, I wasn't warm for a week except when I was about the second mile of that one way, that march to the rifle range. We'd shoot all day, pack up, march back. We had little bitty pup tents, literally little bitty basic like World War II type tents. We had no matches. We had nothing to keep warm. Had to keep your boots inside of your sleeping bag with you because it'd freeze at night and cut your ankles or the back of your, like your Achilles tendon is right there, kind of.
Yeah.
I found that out the hard way. You shaved out of your steel pot. I mean, it was very, very basic. It was very, very miserable, actually.
Okay. Did you have any contact with your family while you're going through basic?
Just letters, you know, things like that. No other contact, though. I mean, we were there. It was the Army. It was, you know, no doubt about that.
How long did it last?
It was about 10 weeks, I think. Right around 10 weeks, something like that.
Okay. Did you witness any injuries or any difficulties by the other men? Or I guess you certainly witnessed the difficulties, but could you describe what those were?
Well, we had some. Of course, I turned 19 during basic. My birthday's in February, and it's really easy to see when I joined in January. There's, I turned 19 during basic training. There was a lot of guys that had been drafted that just finished teaching college, just finished college, rather, and been drafted out right afterwards. I remember one guy was in our unit was 26, which is pretty old for basic training, actually.
Yeah.
And he was kind of a small guy. He was a history teacher, which is strange. That's what I'm going to looking and doing myself right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember he marched in front of me and had to help him a lot and kind of push him and talk to him. And he got through and finally went in. I think he went into an armor unit or something. A lot of guys that turned down commissions that were college graduates, and almost every single one of them seemed like got a combat arm of some type.
Okay.
Almost as punishment it looked like.
When you got through when you were during basic training, did you keep that patriotic feeling, you know, that you said you had a little bit of that?
Yeah, we pretty well did. We sung all the songs, you know, about being an airborne ranger and all this.
Right.
And they offered us things like that. And I even was an assistant instructor in the bayonet training and was on the kind of like the drill team. We had a like you see the guys, you know, they do the guns and you go out and march and you kick them around and swirl and do various things.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like an honor guard type deal. We performed at the actual graduation ceremony.
Okay.
So I guess you can say, yeah, kept it all the way through.
Okay. Excellent. What kind of weapons training did you receive in basic?
In basic, it was mostly the M14. We threw a few grenades, but it was basically the M14, which we didn't see much after that. We were one of the last ones to use the M14, I think, after they switched to the M16s.
Mm-hmm.
14's a lot heavier, standard NATO rifle with a 7.62 caliber bullet for it, which is a heavier gun than we used in Vietnam very much, except it's a sniper weapon, so I think.
Right. Had you handled weapons before you got the basic?
Well, being up, you know, center of the South here, I grew up, you know, hunting some and fishing. So I'd been out deer hunting and squirrel hunting and things like that before. Not a lot, but some.
Okay. What was your personal preference of weapons? I mean, you did the M14. Did you train on, I mean, grenades, any rocket launchers or anything like that?
No, just in standard basic. It was just really the M14, and then we threw some grenades, but most of it was just the M14. It was just basic training, literally.
Okay. How would you rate that your training experience? Do you feel like you were trained well in basic?
Yeah, I thought we were trained, you know, pretty well, really. It was not much relief. I mean, you were in the Army, you did it their way pretty much. The ones that didn't were handled pretty roughly, so
right.
It was obviously in your favor to not to know you really, not to do too good or too bad, actually.
I've heard that before about kind of blending in. And
yeah, it's much better. If they know your name, then they got somebody to pick out. Even for whatever reason, it's not good.
Right. Were any of your instructors Vietnam veterans, or had they seen any combat before?
Yeah, we had, I think all of them were just about. Some of them were even a little nervous and jerky. Most of our DIs or drill instructors had been. The captain we had, just a little bitty guy, he would also have been there. Our favorite instructor was a black sergeant that had just gotten back that was real good. I'll never forget him saying, "You're not in your mama's kitchen anymore, boys." I mean, and he told us pretty straight. I don't remember the man's name, but he was a good soldier. I liked him.
Was his name, by the way, Draper?
I have no idea.
I had interviewed another veteran recently, and he spoke of a black DI who was excellent at Fort Leonard Wood. Yeah, yeah.
This is a great guy. He's a real tall black guy.
Uh-huh.
About, of course, I'm 6'2". He's taller than I am. He's about 6'7", and real thin.
Okay. What did they tell you about Vietnam?
Oh, we asked him things like, you know, what's it like to be in combat, and what's it going to be like? And he said, well, they're just as scared as you are. Don't worry, you know.
Okay.
He said, they're just afraid as you are of them. And I thought it made a lot of sense, actually, so we're all human in the first place.
Yeah, okay. When you finally did get to Vietnam, looking back at your basic training, how prepared do you think it helped made you?
Well, about as much as you could be prepared. I mean, you can't really do it. Of course, in the winter, it wasn't really the greatest training for Vietnam.
Right.
It wouldn't be much snow if I ever saw, anyway. It rained a lot. And it was hot a lot.
Okay.
Other than the climatic differences, then I went to Fort Devens, which was also cold. It was in Massachusetts.
This is for your advanced training?
Yes, my advanced training. Spent almost a year there.
Okay.
And the training that I did was good, but you never can quite get it all. And, of course, I wasn't in an infantry unit, so I guess what I had was ample and basic. I knew how to shoot a gun and to keep my head down.
Okay. Let's talk about your advanced training. What was that like?
That was it was different than anything I actually anticipated. It was the Army Security Agency we were involved in. It was an MI branch. In fact, now I think it's back into MI or military intelligence. Mm-hmm. That part it was separated. They've kind of cloned it back into it. We were involved in communication security in various forms. They took you up there, and then they trained you, and after you developed a certain level of expertise, and they would move you into different areas, essentially. There was a lot of Morse code training, which was a real pain, and various military acronyms, things, just the basic information that you need for communications and basic radios. And then they slowly divided us into different areas. We became obviously more proficient in one area or another. Some more people who are actually intercept operators that could take real quick Morse code.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them went to like the Sinop, Turkey, and places like that where they were intercepting Russians at times, since they still used Morse code a great deal. The ones that were very good tend to get those kind of jobs.
Okay.
I was not as proficient, thank God. I didn't go to Turkey anyway. I didn't want to go to Vietnam either, though. But actually for Germany, but that's another story. And I got in this O5G training, which was a communication security monitor. We actually monitor our own troops and showed them where they had, you know, screwed up essentially or made mistakes in their communication procedures, and it was getting them shot.
Okay.
They were doing things in the clear where Charlie was intercepting or could intercept them, and
right.
You know, things of that nature.
How did you get into that?
Well, I guess that was by virtue of elimination. I wasn't quick enough to be. When we called Diddy Bops, or the guys who intercepted, and they just more or less put me in that area.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it. And, you know, that was no choice.
Okay. Well, now, when you actually first went to your advanced training, how did you get the military security type, military intelligence?
Well, I had enlisted when I enlisted, from when I joined the Army for 4 years. I was allowed to pick what I wanted, and I picked the Army Security Agency.
Okay. Okay.
So I could pick that area, but not exactly what I would do with inside of it.
Okay. I got you. All right, so basically you trained for a year there. This was in Massachusetts.
It was almost, I think it was 11 months, but it was almost a year.
Okay, and you trained in this basic communications and learning all the equipment and
right.
Okay, and how long into that advanced training until you found out you were going to Vietnam?
We didn't know to the very end when we got our orders. You did not know until, like, the last minute.
Okay, did you suspect that that's where you might be going?
Well, we had an idea, of course. It was 1969 at the time, but you never know. I asked for Germany. I thought, you know, I'd go there and see Europe, and that'd be nice, and I wouldn't have to go there and do this other thing, but that's not what happened.
Okay. Describe how you felt when you got those orders. You knew you were going.
Well, it was kind of like, oh, well, you know, I didn't really know what to think. Again, I was just a kid. I was 19 then, I think. I took my leave, went home, and talked to my parents. Of course, my mother wasn't crazy about the idea, having lost her first husband in World War II.
Right.
And I was the only one of the two brothers, and I had one sister that ever went in the military, actually. So I'm sure she worried a lot, and heard later she, you know, was really upset while I was gone, especially at Christmas time.
Yeah. How long was your leave?
It was 30 days, I believe, because I'd be gone for a year, and you get 30 days a year, which sometimes you get to take, and this time I did have to go 30 days, I believe.
Okay. And you went home, basically?
Yeah, went home, stayed there, and then, went back to where I reported to, I think it was Oakland, where I had to go to be shipped overseas.
Okay. Well, describe when you were leaving, I guess, going over to Oakland. Did you land in Oakland and immediately get board plane for Southeast Asia, or were you housed there for a few days?
Well, we had to be issued new equipment. I took a plane out of El Dorado, which is where I was living at Denver, went to high school and everything. I flew out there. You go through the, you show up at the repo depot or your deployment depot, and you walk in and you show them your orders, and they give you two pairs of this and two pairs of that and the duffel bag and give you all your equipment. Then you just wait around to get your flight, essentially. You're there for a couple of days, basically a processing time, I guess, maybe.
Okay. All right. And so you were there for a couple of days, and you boarded the flight. Can you talk about that flight overseas when you left the United States?
Yeah, of course. Then they were flying everybody in great, big, beautiful airplanes. I mean, it was a fairly easy trip, except I've never flown 13,000 miles before, being born on the plane before you got there. You're ready to get off. It's a never-ending plane trip, and we had to switch planes a couple of times. I went through Anchorage. Flew from California to Anchorage, which if you look on a globe, doesn't look like it should work, but apparently it's a pretty quick hop.
Right.
And then into Japan. Actually, we had an engine go out on the way over, which I thought was a foreboding deal. And we landed in Japan, and they had to do something to an engine. They put us over in the enlisted men's club, their EM club, as we called it, and we were just flabbergasted. These beautiful Japanese girls were dancing with these lucky, airmen over there. I thought, man, what a deal. These girls were beautiful. We, drank beer, stuck a bunch in our pockets if we could, and ate a steak, and eventually got back on the plane when they fixed it.
Wow. Okay. And so from there, you went straight to where, Okinawa?
We were in Japan, then that was Shida, I think, is where we landed, I believe. But when we left Japan, we went straight to Saigon.
Okay. All right. What was the mood on the plane?
Well, we didn't know. We were kids, we just like anybody before they've ever been there. You don't know.
Right.
You don't know. It's kind of euphoric. I mean, there's some guys returning, obviously some officers and some NCOs, or your non-coms, your sergeant types that have been there before, and they're a little more subdued, but most of us are semi-rowdy, and they had these beautiful stewardess where everybody was, oogling the whole way.
Right.
Scandinavian girls or something had a great accent, and they were all just gorgeous, it seemed like.
Okay, so you're kind of distracted there.
Oh, yeah, we're definitely distracted. It was always a big party at this point.
Right, okay. So you land in Saigon. Describe that when you landed and you got off the plane.
Well, we got off the plane, and there were soldiers waiting to get on the plane. And they had faded uniforms, and ours were all brand new, and you could tell we were, new guys, or
right.
FNGs, as they called us.
Right.
For a frigging new guy, would be the polite way to say that.
Say whatever you need to say.
Right, well, you can figure out the rest.
Oh, yeah.
That's vernacular, I guess you might say. But anyway, they were waiting to get on a plane, and they were cheering, and they were happy, and they were saying, look out for the claymores and things like that, and, they walked past us and got on, and I remember that's from the first time, I saw some of these big metal, it's like sardine cans, but they said human remains on it, which I didn't catch what it was at first, but those were obviously, human remains going back.
Yeah.
They were dead soldiers.
Okay. How would you describe the morale of the American troops that you were landing with?
It seemed, everybody still seemed, I didn't see any morale problems anywhere, at least initially. There weren't any that I could tell. Even the guys getting on the plane, this was still 1969. Things hadn't gotten real bad back in the States yet, I don't think. I remember. But it seemed fine. I mean, everybody was, we were young men.
Okay. Did you understand at that point why you were there?
Well, I knew we were there to stop communist aggression in Southeast Asia, basically in a nominal theory was, essentially what everybody knew.
Okay.
And that we were there to help people, kind of like, I always kind of compared it to North and South Korea, to, help South Korea make its own self-determination and be a democracy.
Right. Okay. What was your first contact with the Vietnamese people? Was it there? I guess there in Saigon.
I guess the first contact would be when we settled in there. I was originally at Tan Son Nhut Air Force Base, which is a huge Air Force base there.
Mm-hmm.
And there I was processed and sent up. And that's the first place I ran into them. They had a lot of foreign nationals or Vietnamese that would live on base and do things for you. They would, they did all the menial work we didn't want to do, and they could be paid. It was all probably good for the local economy, too, and they would shine the shoes and, take care of the cleaning problems and did a lot of the KT work and things like that.
Okay. What was your impression of the Vietnamese people at that point?
Well, they were fine. I mean, I didn't know. I've never been around any, Asians at that point, and initially I was still, kind of glad to be there, I guess, in a way. We went downtown in Saigon and went to the bars and things and, you know, had fun for a while.
Okay. How long were you there in Saigon?
Oh, initially, the first time I was there, I was only there for maybe a few weeks. I was sent up to play coup, which we had four platoons in our unit, basically. There was one. The 3rd platoon was the headquarter unit there in Saigon. The 2nd platoon was in Pleiku. The 1st platoon was in Da Nang. And then the 4th platoon was in Kanto, which is in four corps down the southern part of the country.
Right, so.
And we did the support operation for ComSec, and they would parcel us out if we needed to go. We'd go with the unit for a while, and we'd listen to them and then give them classes on what they did wrong and things like that to some degree.
Okay. Can you describe that for, like, you know, what exactly your job was?
Since the 2nd platoon, first of all, I found out there I was allergic to malaria pills.
Okay.
I thought I had a free ride home. Sent me back down to, I thought wrong. They sent me down to Saigon again, and a doctor down there said, no, you can stay in Saigon. It's a relatively free non-malaria area. I said, what do you mean relatively free? He said, just that. Most people won't get it here.
Right.
And I thought, after that, I never took another pill again because I got the big hives, and even though I did two tours, I never worried about it, and obviously the wrong mosquito never bit me because I don't have malaria today.
Yeah.
Back to what we actually did, though, we would monitor. We were kind of like Big Brother in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Literally, we would go in and listen, be it an Air Force command. I've listened to generals talk. I've listened to nurses talk. That was really interesting. Just depending on whatever unit we'd be listening to, when I was in the first tour especially, we would normally go in and tap into their phone exchange and wire into it, and then sit there all day long and record what they were saying, doing through various different things. We were, you know, wiretapping or eavesdropping on our own people, trying to keep them from giving information out.
Okay. Were you on the ground doing this, or were you in the air?
No, we were on the ground. Okay. We were in the telephone exchanges. There were big telephone exchanges. You know, the country had been built up somewhat, and it was a country, and they had telephone exchanges like you have here, like Southwestern Bell.
Right.
And we'd go in there, and then the mechanical people, the technicians would wire us in, and the monitors, like myself, would stay there all day long and monitor it and record things and write little synopsis on our little pads and how many calls we did and things like that.
Did the people know they were being recorded?
No.
Wow.
Sometimes they knew if the officer in charge didn't want to get a bad report, he might spread the word around. You could tell sometimes they wouldn't know, but they weren't supposed to know.
Okay. And so did you ever listen to combat situations, or was it mainly just instructions in the field? Or
It varied. Like, I heard some generals once talking about ARC-LIC, which is a B-52 bombing strikes, coming out of Cambodia. I mean, not coming out of Cambodia, coming out of Thailand.
Right.
And they were talking about, they're giving coordinates and things like that. And everybody looked down and thought I had a big deal. These guys definitely were saying things they shouldn't be saying.
Right.
But the report was never sent in because they were generals, and you didn't mess with generals.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I mean, which generals do you remember who you listened to?
There were some Air Force generals. I have no idea who they were in hindsight. They were like major generals. They had a couple of stars.
Right. Okay. Did you like this work, or did you find it boring or exciting?
Well, it got boring after a while because there wasn't much to it. It was, you know, basically just sit there and record and flip around. After a while, I got promoted fairly fast and I became an analyst, which was a little more fun. Then you took the raw information and you try to sit down and figure out what was going on in that unit and write a report based around the raw data that had been taken by the monitors.
Right. Again, how long were you doing the listening, and then you transitioned to the analyst? How long was that?
Probably in my first tour, probably six months, something like that. I was a monitor, then I was moved into an analyst. I got promoted fairly fast up to the E5 rank, and there's 9 enlisted ranks, so I got to the E5 level pretty quick.
Okay. All right. The first 6 months you were there, you're in Pleiku?
About a month. They sent me back down to Saigon because of the malaria pill deal.
You stay down there in Saigon then?
Right, we stayed in Saigon most of the time, but then they'd send us out to other places too. It was, you know, you're stationed in Saigon, you might go to Kanto for 2 weeks on a mission.
Okay.
You'd do a convoy, and you'd drive down there, and you would do whatever the monitoring request was.
What kind of sidearms did you carry?
We had almost a gun in our pocket. It seemed like the longer you got there, the more guns you collected, you would, you know, swap out, or somebody would be leaving and you'd trade them for something. We were issued 14s, M14s originally, which we carried on guard duty there in Saigon. After a while, we were going to the field more. We had M16s. I did some, because we all had top secret clearances. If I didn't mention that, we had top secret crypto clearances, and we would carry 45s whenever we're doing courier work, or sometimes they were short on guys who could do this, which was kind of silly in a way. But anyway, I carry a 45 when I was doing any courier work. We had an M1 carbine, and later we acquired some M79 grenade launchers. So we tried to stay pretty well armed whenever we went anywhere, because you never knew it was going to happen.
Right. Describe that courier work you did.
Well, the courier work was just It was just that. I mean, it gave you some stuff to carry, and you'd get it, you'd wait for a chopper somewhere, and then you'd catch it like you would a bus here in the States, and it would fly you somewhere. They had regular, you know, stops and pickups, and you would drop off. You'd pick up this document, fly over here, and drop it off someplace else. And these helicopters, of course, these guys thought they were John Wayne, and helicopters got kind of scary a couple times, because you know, those things are just big tin cans, and we always carried two flak vests. You sat on one for obvious reasons, and you wore one because they were shooting up from below you.
Okay. Did you ever get fired upon?
Yeah, we had been flying at night when they had green tracers and we had red tracers. They had like 51 caliber machine guns. We had 50 caliber, so they could use our bullets. We couldn't use theirs. I thought it was pretty smart, really, for communists.
Oh.
And so sometimes even the red tracers were there, but every seventh bullet is a tracer, and sometimes it'd be a solid line of green tracers right outside your door, you know, your window there, and that wouldn't cool out in blank. These guys wanted to go down and shoot them. I'd always pull out my clearance sheet that said top secret, or even if it was confidential, I always carried a top secret. That way I'd get the guy's attention. I'd tap on a pilot's head and show him that and do my finger up, and he had to fly away from me. It's incoming, which I thought was a good idea, personally.
That's a pretty good security mechanism.
Well, it worked.
Yeah. Okay, so describe living in Saigon. What was that like?
Well, Saigon, when you're a young man and all the sins that are available there, you know, the bars and bordellos of Saigon, we had a riotous time, I guess, if all men do in all wars.
Okay.
When they have a chance.
What did you do, exactly?
We would go, for entertainment purposes, when we went to Saigon, we'd usually go to a bar and try to pick up a girl. You know, a Vietnamese girl, which usually cost you X number of piastres. It was a prostitution deal, obviously.
Uh-huh.
And you'd pay them whatever it was going right, and you could pick them out just like you go to the candy store, almost.
Huh. It was I guess it was really easy to get these girls.
Oh yeah, I mean it just took money.
Huh.
I mean sure.
Okay, all right. When you were in these bars, were you around people who were on leave from the field?
Yeah, there was all kinds of guys. You'd have a mix of humanity there. Saigon was really interesting, like any I guess Southeast Asia place is. I mean it was just a mass humanity, teaming and bicycles and dong carts, as we called them. It was just a mass humanity everywhere. There was all kinds of soldiers, sailors, marines, airmen, officers, enlisted. I mean, it was just a mixed humanity.
What was the morale like? I'm sure they were happy to be there, you know, in a bar versus in the field.
Though. It was pretty good overall. You did see some racial problems come in after a while. A lot of the black soldiers, I don't know what happened out in the field, but there were some incidents. You'd see them that have, you know, these black hand salutes. They would do it, take them 5 minutes to shake hands sometimes, the same way. And we always thought that was funny, which they didn't like, of course, either.
Right.
But there wasn't but a few in our unit, and they were all great guys. Out in the field, I don't know, obviously there were some problems with some units. But I wasn't really privy to a lot of that. But I did see them being a little aggressive sometimes on the street to Saigon, but never pointing guns or anything. At least I didn't see that.
So there really weren't any race issues that you noticed?
That I saw
personally,
no, would hear about somebody shooting in a barracks, you know, and things like that. But it didn't happen where I was, not for racial reasons, later for tension reasons. We had some incidents, but never that I know for any racial reasons. We all got along fine.
Okay.
In the units I was in.
Describe those tension-related incidents.
Well, that was later on during my second tour, to jump ahead a little bit. During the second tour, when I had come back, I'd spent 4 months after I finished my first tour. I'd gone to Fort Devens, you know, to Fort Meade, Maryland, where I was with the 414th Armored there for about 4 months. It was right there, you know, down from D.C. on the Beltway, where Fort Meade is located. That's where NSA headquarters is, for example. And it was just pretty boring. People didn't like you very much. I was spit on once in the airport and had my uniform on because I was a GI, you know.
Well, yeah, we'll get to that point about your reception back here in the United States. During this first tour again.
Okay, back to the first tour.
Yeah, so you were there. It was a year. You were basically stationed in Saigon, and you did this courier work. You went out on missions. When you go, like you said, you went on these two-week missions down the Canto. What was that like?
Those active several missions like that. Canto, up with the 5th Special Forces for a month at their headquarters unit at Cameron Bay, I believe, and we'd go and we'd get in a C-130, we'd drive our truck in there with our camo hut on the back of it, and we'd fly down there, or we would drive down there, depending on the situation. Then you'd unload and hook up, and you had this mobile unit, essentially, and you would listen to, you know, the traffic and do the reports, like I mentioned before, and then turn them in.
Okay, so you're basically down there. You listen to what was happening, and then you'd come back.
Right. Same thing when we were at the Special Forces and things like that. Okay. We just whatever was going on, we were sent there.
Okay. So you did some traveling there. What did you think of Vietnam, the country itself?
I thought it was really other than obviously the holes in the ground from the bombing in some cases, but it was which you see more when you're flying in a chopper. But it was a beautiful country actually. There was little Buddhist little monuments or whatever they have, altars everywhere. It was really a pretty country, other than the fact that the war was going on and tearing it up. The Pleiku, the Central Highlands, was extremely beautiful. It kind of reminds me of North Arkansas or any place where you have mountainous areas and rivers and things like that.
Right.
The country is a beautiful country.
Okay. And as you were there longer, what did you think of the Vietnamese people?
Well, the longer you were there, I think you tended to look down on some of the Vietnamese soldiers. They didn't seem like they really wanted to do the deal very much. It was their country, and I think they kind of just caved in and let us do it. I think a lot of the problem, though, on further reflection and more education now, is with their officer corps was probably corrupt.
Okay. So, yeah, you're talking about Arvin here.
Yeah, the Arvin, yeah.
Yeah, so you feel like they just kind of caved, or...
Except for the elite unit, some of which were pretty neat. In the first two, we were right across from where the trains at Arvin Airborne. When I was on Thompson Newt, the Arvin Airborne train right across from us, which is the reason we got hit a lot, because they were right there, plus those other jets close by.
Right.
Well, they parked them in the bunkers. Some of them were great. I never had any problems with them, per se, but it just didn't seem like they were just that. I guess they've been at war so long, it didn't matter anymore. I don't know. The corruption was so great. I didn't think the general population was really behind it that much. But I never had any complaints to any of the Arvin soldiers I was around, per se, or any of the Koreans I was around.
What were the Koreans like?
Well, the Koreans were great guys. We were going somewhere, maybe when we were going to with the Special Forces that time, but we stopped at one airbase, and it was going to be several hours before we got our next flight, and some Arvins walked by and asked me to wash your vehicle, and I said, sure. And they said, well, come on, Sergeant, go with us. I was a buck sergeant by then, and I had two other guys underneath me, and I said, sure. These guys could walk like jackrabbits. We walked over to their compound, which is several miles away. I had no idea what I was getting myself in for here. Mm-hmm. We walked over there and went to their officers' club, and we sat there and drank beer until we couldn't drink it, and they told me their war stories and how they're there for 2 years and mm-hmm. not 1 year like us, and they were real proud. They were real tough about it. They liked mm-hmm. us a lot.
Okay.
And we drank until we couldn't drink anymore, and we had to, walk back this 4 or 5 miles, what it was. Mm-hmm. Didn't seem to bother them as much as it did me, but I had a large time.
Okay. Can we talk about, if you don't mind, your religion there? There's a cliche that when you're in the field, when you're in a war situation, that people tend to get more religious. They tend to.
Well, I've always heard that. And I guess maybe if you're in a hole getting pounded up by artillery, that's probably more true. I think that's probably my least religious period in my life.
Really?
I guess because I was just young and tough, and I was going to live forever. Right. And there's nothing wrong with me, whatsoever. Probably had my least amount of any religious inclination the whole time I was in the Army. I just kind of lost touch with it completely, and as I got back, I heard my mother more and things like that. I started going to church again, but when I was in the military, it was almost a non-event for me.
Okay. Was there a lot of alcohol use amongst the troops?
Yes.
Okay. And was this basically in the bars? I guess you witnessed this in Saigon more.
In the bars and on the bases, too. I mean, there's not much to do. Like you see in anything, there's long periods of nothing going on where you're bored to tears and then something happens, which you wish hadn't happened, perhaps. But it's long, boring periods where you don't do very much. And alcohol was readily available. We had nickel beer. We had bars on base, enlisted men's clubs, we were called EM clubs, or NCO clubs. If you're like a sergeant, I could go to both because I was actually both men on an E5. I could go to both places.
Okay.
And I used to go with EM clubs, though. But, they had nickel nights for beer, quarter nights for quarter for mixed drinks. I mean, you could just hurt yourself a few dollars.
Wow. What kind of beer did you have available?
Well, they'd have most of the standard brands. Sometimes you got stuck with nothing but just Carling and Black Label, which was never that great. But depending on what had been flown in, but you could usually find what you wanted in the nicer clubs you could, especially in NCO clubs you could. The EM club wasn't quite as stocked, but there was usually plenty of booze around everywhere. All you could drink, it was incredible.
Wow. Okay. How about drug use? Did you see a lot of drug use or not?
I didn't see any during my first tour.
Okay.
I'd heard about it a little bit, but I was still, boy from El Dorado, Arkansas, that, an Eagle Scout, and I was straight arrow. I wasn't around it very much. I didn't, not at all the first year. I only heard a few whispers about it but I never saw it at all my first tour.
Okay. How about your second tour?
My second tour, the first thing they told me is, Sergeant Shivers, things have changed. Try this. I wasn't even checked in yet.
Really?
I said, guys, I can't do this. They said, yeah, you can. They had a joint road. And I said, I hadn't even checked in, so don't worry, it's already taken care of. I said, what's happened? So while I was gone that 4 months, I was in the 414th up at Fort Meade. Mm-hmm. That's when Nixon sent the troops into Cambodia, mm-hmm. chasing that big NVA headquarters unit.
Uh-huh.
And the guys, when they came back, it was totally different. It was like somebody just, it was like black and white.
Wow.
I mean, it's the strangest thing, but it's like a 180 happened. Even in my unit where guys had all top secret clearances,
uh-huh.
and most of them had some college at that point, it was just overnight. It went from straight to Haight-Ashbury almost.
Wow. Why do you think that was?
I think then, during those few months, that I guess that it really soaked in more about the whole negative situation back in the States. I mean, we saw it all the time on TVs anyway. When I was there, all the riots were going on in D.C., the Days of Rage or whatever it was, and they blocked all the traffic in D.C. one day. And, you know, it was just incredible what was going on. I mean, it was all kinds of protests. I couldn't believe it sometimes. We put a man on the moon, and we had this going on, and we had these riots. I mean, it was just incredible what was going on in the United States at the time. It was just real busy.
Now, did you first witness this when in person, I guess, or maybe when you went back to Maryland to do your training?
The what? The
the 4 months you spent back stateside, did you witness any of these protests?
Only on television.
Okay.
I didn't actually go. Because it just wasn't advisable. I mean, it was obvious.
Right.
But the clothes we had, and our short haircuts, and only shoes we really have, these low quarters, which was military dress shoes.
Right.
And we stuck it like a sore thumb.
Okay.
And most people treated you like you were second-class citizens, so that it wasn't worth the put-down. I mean, I went down to D.C. a few times, but it really wasn't worth the put-down.
Okay. What when you flew back to the States, I mean, what was that like for you? Did you know you were going back for a second tour? Or?
I volunteered to go back for a second tour.
Now, why did you volunteer to go back?
Because I got just sick of where I was at Fort Meade, Maryland.
Okay.
It was just a boring deal. There was some tension there between some of the blacks, and not with me, but with some other guys that were really hardcore Southerners, I guess you might say, from South Carolina. Especially those guys tend to be a little more radical sometimes, I think.
Uh-huh.
And there was a little bit of problem with their, you know, they were dead talk. It'd just be talk stuff, and nothing ever happened physically. But you could see some tension was developing then.
Okay.
And it just wasn't any fun. I mean, it was boring. We had nothing really to do. We were just hanging out, actually. We were doing nothing on a daily basis. We'd get in our little APCs, armed personnel carriers, and we'd drive around out in the woods somewhere and sit back and, you know, have some beer stashed. We'd drink beer and fart, you know, just goof off all day. There was nothing going on.
Huh.
And it was easier in a way to go back. Actually, when I got back, I was glad to be back, as strange as that sounds now. I was back where I understood what was going on. It was just like going home almost when I got back to Vietnam the second time.
Really?
Now, yeah, it was strange in hindsight, especially, but I remember feeling relieved to be back and out of the States and all the commotion going on.
Wow, that's interesting. So you were committed to the Army for 4 years, is that correct?
Yeah, I joined for 4 years. I got out a little early because when I got back off my second tour, if you had 6 months or less, they gave you an early out.
Okay, so when you went back to Maryland, to Fort Meade, I mean, you knew that you were going to be in for another, you know.
Oh, I had another couple of years.
Yeah, a couple of years, so. So you felt that was perhaps just a better deal, just to go back and.
Yeah, I mean, I just couldn't stand it. I mean, it was just too strict, too much. It was just, I don't know. It just was very trying, and I didn't like it at all.
How were you treated by the civilians in the United States when you came back?
Well, you know, as a big military area, they get kind of, I guess, so used to you, and you spending money and everything, you don't really get the respect, I don't think, or the treatment you should, especially during Vietnam for all the obvious reasons we know about now, but.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I got spit on the airport once, and I wasn't treated that well. People would ignore you, look down on you a little bit. It was distasteful.
Can you describe that spitting incident?
That happened to a little girl when I was in Washington, and it was called Washington then. That's Reagan International Airport now.
Uh-huh.
And I'd walk by this young college girl. She just turned around and spit on my shoes and walked by, and I tried and gave her a look, and by that time an MP walked up, and I told him what happened. He just told me to go on and, you know, to shake it off.
Huh. And this is when you're coming back from your first tour?
Yes.
Okay. She didn't say anything to you?
No, smirky just deals like you're not any good kind of looks.
Uh-huh.
You know, the look.
Yeah, did you find that was a common experience with Vietnam veterans coming back, or was that sporadic, or what?
I've heard some other people say the same thing. I don't know how common it was, or even caught. I mean, it didn't come spit in my face or anything. It just kind of spit at my shoes when I, you know, hit my shoes when I walked by, but it was on purpose.
Right.
They were showing the fact they thought I was some kind of baby killer or rapist, murderer, or whatever. I don't know.
Right.
Which was couldn't further from the truth.
Did you feel like, you know, telling her or
confronting? It wouldn't have done any good. I mean, there wasn't an open mind to deal with.
Right, right.
She already had a judgment, obviously. She didn't know me.
Yeah, obviously. When you were there in your first tour, how much TV exposure, how did you know what was going on back in the States? Were you able to watch TV every night?
We didn't really have TV. We had the Stars and Stripes. We had radios. Stars and Stripes, you know, was a military publication.
Uh-huh.
I can't remember any TVs. We had some outdoor movies we'd go to. We hung a big sheet up. We'd throw beer cans at it. We'd watch the movies. It was kind of something out of, you know, MASH or something. But,
So you were able to keep up with the news back then?
You could pretty well. There may have been some TVs. I don't remember any TVs offhand at all. There must have been some somewhere, but I don't remember any.
Okay. So let's just talk about your second tour. You go back in country. Where are you assigned, and what are you going to be doing?
Because the second tour, I went back. In fact, I went to a briefing there at the NSA headquarters for which is fairly interesting.
Uh-huh.
I'd seen some of the work I'd done during the first tour.
Okay.
They were using as briefing material on this Project Touchdown.
Okay.
And that was a thing I got a award for during the first time. This one, it was late in my first tour. back when the 25th Infantry had captured a Vietnamese or NVA VC, you know, NVA/VC intel unit that was below ground. They were intercepting our information. They were kind of like our counterparts.
Right.
And they were intercepting it, and they had written down in longhand English, which amazed me, on small rice paper, pieces of rice paper that were rectangular shaped, mm-hmm. you know, about maybe size of a regular piece of paper, about a half that size, if you fold it in half. And they had the call signs down there, and whoever they were talking about, you know, they had a little synopsis of what was going on. They were collecting intel, like on the Big Red One of the 25th Infantry Division, whoever they were monitoring, they had it down there.
Wow.
It was a great thing we found. The 25th Infantry found, and they called me as being an analyst on it. And this little piece of rice paper, I put little initials over a corner. When I was going, there was hundreds of them. I was going through them. I could tell which ones I'd been through, mm-hmm. and did a big report on it. They had that as a briefing material at the NSA headquarters, which was kind of interesting. I asked a bunch of questions. They didn't know who I was at the time. That I was a guy who had a little DS over a corner, which I explained to them. They all got excited for a little while. but after. I had the briefing, you know, flew back, basically had another leave, went home, saw my parents again, flew back, about the same deal, checked in, like I told you, real quick, the guys taking me to the airport, they knew I was coming, had my old bunk back and everything.
Okay, how did your parents feel about you going back for a second tour?
Oh, my mother almost died, I think.
Really?
I heard later my sister, she cried about every day I was gone. I mean, in hindsight, she just passed away this last summer. I mean, it was a very trying time for her, obviously, and I missed two Christmases.
Yeah.
And for many years, I heard about the Christmases, I wasn't there, you know.
Yeah.
It was a sad deal for her, obviously.
Yeah, okay. So where did you go in country when you went back to Vietnam the second time?
Second time, we by then had moved to Long Bend, or actually the plantation end of Long Bend, which was about 30 miles, I think it was, I forgot which direction, east or west of Saigon. It was in that area, but it was, you know, 30, 40 miles from there. It was a huge army base, and plantation was the very end of it. In fact, it was part of been overrun in 68, which was not always a, you know, good feeling. During the big Tet Offensive, they got overrun. They had them inside the wires there.
Right.
And we were stationed. We had been there. I'd been there towards the end of my first tour, went back there to the same place, and we would do missions out of there. We would go somewhere, or we would stay there.
Okay.
The longer I was in my second tour, though, the less we had to do. As more and more units were leaving Vietnam, they were already doing the drawdown then. It started with the 199th, and Nixon started withdrawing troops, and so it was less and less people to support. And after a while, we didn't have a whole lot to do towards the end. I was giving classes to incoming officers on this Operation Touchdown, which had the first year. We used it as a big training class to go out. And mostly during my second tour, what I did was go out and give classes to incoming officers or grunts or whatever they might be on this particular threat,
okay.
this communication security threat, and how to counter it and what to do and how to use their little code books and stuff like that.
Make sure they didn't spill any secrets or they acted properly while they were talking?
Right. It was kind of an orientation deal, plus they had to have, like anything, you have to be retrained sometimes and reminded of things, and we'd go out sometimes and give classes to them in the field or do a monitoring mission or whatever it would be.
How was it like when you went to the field and talked to these guys? Were they resentful of you that you had a rear position, or?
I'm sure some of them did. I probably would have been too if I'd been these, you know, young guys. But they were most of them. You know, they bucked from the line. We were telling them, you know, the right stuff, and I had a pretty good program down. We had the captured equipment we used and demonstrations, and it got to be, you know, pretty good, you know, 25, 30 minute, whatever. We can make it longer or shorter if we wanted to, type of presentation. And it actually was good information for them. Hopefully it saved some lives.
How often did you go out in the field to do that?
It just, whenever we were assigned, it would vary. It might go a couple times in a week, might not go for 2 weeks, might be somewhere for 2 weeks. It would just depend on whatever mission came down and we were told what to do and where to go.
Okay. Did you, back there at your base near Long Bend, did you pull guard duty?
Yeah, we had guard duty every, even when I got to be an E5, which is fairly quickly, I had guard duty every fourth night I was there for both tours. Every third or fourth night I was on the guard duty. I had big bunkers with machine guns and everything there.
What did you do? Did you just hang out in the bunkers, or did you walk around?
We would normally stay in the bunkers. If we heard anything, we'd shoot flares up. We went out and checked our clackers, we had what they call flue gas, which was basically napalm on the ground. It was pretty nasty stuff. That was wired up in Claymore mines. You always go out and check them, make sure they weren't pointed towards you, which Charlie would do sometimes. He'd come in and turn the mines around, so when you shot them off, they stopped shooting about 10,000 ball bearings at you instead of him.
Wow.
So I would make sure they're pointing the right direction. I had to be careful. I had to, of course, their C4 in there, which was pretty explosive. And then you sit there and wait and see what happened. And you'd be up in a tower or down on the ground in a guard bunker type deal, or up in a tall one that was made out of huge, basically telephone type poles. And you had M60 machine gun. You had the clackers, which was the firing pins for the napalm on the ground, as well as for the Claymore mines. And then you had flares. You had M79 grenade launchers. You had your M16s, and you had everything laid out and loaded and ready. I mean, it was. If something happened, I mean, you had plenty to shoot with for a while anyway.
Did anything ever happen when you were on duty?
Not really. We would get shelled sometimes. There wasn't very many actual times we got hit. I was fairly lucky. It either happened the day before I got there or the day after I left. It seemed like the whole time I was over there. A few times you might pop off some rounds if you heard something out there, just to make sure and keep them honest. But not that I know of that I actually shoot anybody. I may have, but I don't. Not that I know of.
So you did fire your own weapon?
Yeah, I did fire. Sometimes when we heard noises, we would shoot. We'd shoot up flares and pop off some rounds and see what happened. If we got any return, and we knew to ask for help real quick and fire what we had.
Okay.
But that never actually happened to me where we got, it was supposed to happen a couple of times, but I never was where there was a full assault or anything.
Okay.
Thank God.
Yeah. Tell me about when you were being shelled. What was that like?
Well, that's really a pretty scary deal because there's nothing you can do. And bunkers are only designed for near misses.
Right.
If you get a direct hit, you're just going to blow up like a tomato juice can. You're just going to be a big pink splash.
Okay.
So that was kind of scary. All you could do is just grab the ground and, pray.
Right.
I've been blown out of bed one time in the middle of the night. That was the closest I ever got to getting it to a trap like it ran on my head, apparently. I never slept on top bunk again. We had some sniper rounds a couple times come close when we were driving our trucks down the road going on a mission. And, of course, the incoming happened all the time in various places. You get, the incoming happened, these 105 rounds, but it happened all the time. A lot of times, most of the time they weren't close, but you could always hear them. It was always scary, and the ground would shake. Sometimes they got close, but usually they weren't.
Okay. Did you ever see the enemy at all?
Well, I probably saw him daily and didn't know it.
Okay.
But far as, no, not that I know of.
You mean you might have seen Viet Cong?
Oh, yeah, because the Viet Cong were just local farmers most of the time.
Right.
It could have even been NVA. I mean, they were all the same race of people. They didn't wear their uniforms out in public, I don't imagine, if they could.
Right.
The NVA were regular units, so they tend to be in the field. Your VC could be anywhere, though.
Uh-huh.
I think in one place, where right after I left, they pulled the barber off the wire. He'd been fried trying to come in. The guy's been cutting people's hair the day before.
Uh-huh.
Was a sapper coming in the next night.
Wow. Okay. That's pretty unusual.
Well, they have them inside the compound working, doing everything in the world for you, and they would be marking off stuff, and they knew right where to put the charges or walk the mortars in and everything.
What kind of defenses did you have for stuff like that when the VC are actually in amongst yourselves?
Well, we had the basic, weapons I mentioned on guard duty. Of course, you had radios. You could call in air support. I've watched the choppers like the Cobra gunships, they would work out in teams of three sometimes. When I was on guard duty, I watched them a couple of times and was glad I wasn't receiving end of them. One of them would come over and had these mini guns that shot several thousand rounds a minute. They're basically Gatling guns, modern Gatling guns,
mm-hmm.
had multiple barrels. And they would come over and they'd be, you just hear kind of a boop, kind of a blast,
mm-hmm.
and you see a wave of fire come out of it, and only every seventh round was a tracer, mm-hmm. and it was a solid sheet of fire come out of it.
Wow.
It would pass. The second one would come in, do the same thing. It would pass. Then the third one would come in, and it would pass. By then, the first one back around again. You catch three of them working on one position. Whoever's on the ground, if they weren't under the ground, literally in a tunnel or something, they were dead.
Hmm. What was your impression of the enemy, starting with the Viet Cong? What did you think of the VC?
Well, from that first mission, especially, that I was really amazed that these people that I thought were pretty uneducated were taking that Project Touchdown I mentioned. They were taking in longhand English, American communications. I was flabbergasted. I didn't think enough of them had that much schooling, basically, on to do that.
Right.
But they weren't writing it in Vietnamese; they were writing it in English.
Okay.
The reason I could read it. I was amazed at their sophistication in that respect. And they had some rude equipment, but they had converted it over, and it worked. I mean, that was all that counts in a war, if it works or not. And it didn't look fancy. Some of it was captured with American equipment. Some of it was a Sony radio that had converted to send and receive. And I was amazed at this particular unit that I dealt with a lot, not in a direct level, but through their work, what they were doing. I was impressed. They obviously were very dedicated.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think they were?
Well, it was, whenever you're picking your homeland, you've got a much stronger situation, I think. Just like when we went into to Germany in World War II, Germans fought even harder. When you're protecting your homeland, you're going to be fighting harder.
Right.
I don't think they looked at it as a civil war as much as we did. The corrupt Vietnamese government, I think, had a big influence on that. And the fact they were just, most of them weren't that educated, and they just had to go do it.
Right.
They took tremendous casualties, but they never showed up. They didn't have the freedom that we have over here to show every, stupid mistake that were made. We essentially, won the battles and lost the war, or at least our surrogates did after we essentially pulled out in 72.
Right. What about the NVA? What did you know about them? What was your impression of the regular army?
I never had any contact with them per se. The evidence I saw and the people I talked to that had been involved with them, they were pretty dedicated and very good. I've seen that when I was with the Special Forces for a month at Cameron.
Mm-hmm.
They had some captured equipment and stuff. It's like they're pretty ingenious, turning coke cans into hand grenades and things like that. Pretty. They could make do with very little.
Right, right. Did you have any R&Rs while you were there?
On my second tour, I took two R&Rs. I didn't have any on my first tour, which was surprising for whatever reason. I went to Bangkok twice during my second tour, especially towards the end.
Mm-hmm.
I've taken them both almost back to back, in fact.
Okay. What was Bangkok like? What did you do?
Bangkok was great. It was again a young man's virtual paradise. For going to bars and restaurants, went on the beach, and we all had girls, and mm-hmm. we just had a large time. We just partied the whole time.
And was it a good morale booster? Or?
That was great.
Yeah?
It was great. What do you think?
Yeah, it sounds like it would help you get away from the war.
It was wonderful. I'd like to have gone to Sydney, but I could never get enough time or something. I don't know how that worked. Been there 2 years. I couldn't get a timing to go over there. But
right. They
said I didn't have enough time in country. I was amazed at that answer, but so I went to Bangkok twice.
Okay. What about USO? Did you ever see any shows?
Yeah, we saw some, not a lot. But there would be some. We watched them occasionally. They were nice when they were around.
What were they like?
Just about what you see on television. There's a bunch of screaming GIs, and there was a bunch of good-looking girls, or Bob Hope up there, or somebody, on the stage telling jokes and doing things. It's just exactly like you see on television.
Right. Did you see Bob Hope, or?
No, I never. I think he drove past where I was once, but I just wasn't ever in the right place to actually see him.
Right. Okay. Did you guys have any pets while you were there?
Any pets?
Yeah.
Yeah, we did. We had, especially that second tour, we had several dogs that were. In fact, one guy took his dog home with him. We called him Earl the dog.
Earl the dog.
He was a good dog. He was always fighting with the big black dog in the next unit, and he usually lost. But every once in a while, he'd get him literally by the what's, and he would win. Then the dog wouldn't come back for a while. He was a pretty particular dog. We'd give him steaks, and he wouldn't eat it. I'd have to pick it up and put it on a plate, then he would eat it. He'd go back behind us, kind of away from us. He was a real interesting dog.
I guess he was a Vietnamese dog. I mean, there from Vietnam.
Well, he was a white dog. I don't know what kind he was, but he was just a mutt, I'm sure, like the other ones. We had a couple of them like that over there that were pretty neat dogs. We had some cats. In fact, one of the cats got pregnant and died, I think. But we had dogs around, yeah.
Okay. Did you ever see any wild animals when you were doing your tours around the country?
I think some mongoose tried to come in on us a couple times. We fired on them, though. We didn't know what they were, but
I didn't. Try to come in the barracks? Or?
Well, on guard duty. They'd be out there messing around in front of you, and you hear a noise, and you just cut loose, and just in case, you know, and they'd fire a couple flares up. And, of course, the ODs, the officers, they would call you what's going on, and you'd tell them. And they'd say, okay. But I don't think we ever, actually, I never had an encounter, you know, with lions or tigers or anything like that.
See any snakes?
No. No, I never saw any snakes, I don't think. The biggest roaches I ever saw in my life, though.
Really?
And the most aggressive roaches I've ever seen in my life. Those bugs were, I don't know, they were on, I don't know. I've seen them come straight at me before. It was weird.
Wow.
Mosquitoes were bad. We had a little tiny fans in our huts, and we'd scrounge up and, you know, turn the barracks into individual cubes, and you'd have your black lights and your posters in there and things like that, you know.
Right.
And we'd have little fans over your bed where, you know, blow constantly and keep the mosquitoes off you normally. But sometimes they'd get in and, especially these big cockroaches were really aggressive. I'll never forget a couple of times when they flew straight at my face, like they were attacking almost. It was kind of weird, yeah.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about the drug use in your second tour? You said it had really changed.
It had changed from a bunch of deadly do-rights almost to, still we did our job and everything, but there was a lot of marijuana around.
Okay, I was going to ask you what type. What did you see?
I did see other people do other things than that, but nobody that I knew did anything besides, you know, drink beer and, you know, smoke. Some people did get into needles. I talked to guys that have done that. I've been around them, and they tried to talk me into it. They weren't actually in our unit, some guys we just ran into, and I thought they were crazy. And there was a lot of heroin I found out also. I didn't even realize what it was. I was going through a unit we were next door to over at Long Bend at one point. We had a couple different locations over there, but it was a cavalry unit. It was the first cavalry, whatever it was. It was a bunch of Liberty vials about the size of thimbles on the ground. I mean, like carpeted the ground. I mean, there was hundreds of thousands of them, and I didn't know what they were. And I asked somebody, and they said, well, you idiot, what's what that is? I have no idea. I said, that's what the heroin comes in.
Huh.
I said, that's those little kids that hold up on the highway drive down there. I said, yeah, they're trying to sell you heroin. That just blew my mind. I had no idea.
Wow.
I was just completely ignorant about that.
Wow.
So apparently it was going on pretty heavy in some of the combat units. When I was stationed some of these guys, I would ask them about that, and they said, yes. Yeah. They got the dogs in, so they smell the marijuana, but we can put the heroin in our cigarettes, and they can't tell.
Wow.
And so that was, I thought, fairly interesting.
Did you ever see any officers doing drugs?
No, but I heard that some of them did after I left. They tried to actually kill our... Our CO after I left.
I was going to ask you about fragging in just a minute, but yeah.
But I've never saw any officers do any drugs per se.
Okay. Well, okay, let's talk about that fragging. Did you ever hear of fragging or talk
about
this?
We heard of it. The only time it ever, well, during the, this is again the second tour, I think. It was first and second tour. We had one guy later found out from New York that threw a thermal grenade. We didn't have, except on guard duty, we didn't have any hand grenades like you see, you know, these pineapple grenades like in World War II. We didn't have those around. We had thermal grenades, which was phosphorus grenades to melt down equipment if it were captured. You know, if you get overrun, you melt down all your, you know, all your crypto stuff, all your classified stuff, you melt down.
Right.
And so we had those kind of grenades. They were just, you know, just white hot. I mean, they could go through a block of a car engine.
Okay.
And one of our, whoever it was, I'm not sure, I think it was a guy, Puerto Rican from New York, that threw one on top of the NCO barracks.
Wow.
Of course, it had a tin roof, and it melted through, and just, you know, no time landed right next to the cook. If it landed on him, of course, it killed him.
Uh-huh.
So they got unhappy about that.
What happened to that guy?
They never caught the guy, to my knowledge. I only found out about it towards the end of this deal. He kind of fessed up right before he left. And he also apparently shot around once through the NCO barracks, and also he threw a gas grenade at the officers' barracks.
Wow.
Which brought a lot of heat down on us. And then he did to our own NEM club, and it really got everybody mad. And why gas us? You know, had these baseball grenades that were gas. You know,
right?
It was tear gas.
This guy was kind of angry.
I don't know. He was angry or crazy or a little both. I don't know. You get kind of crazy after a while when you've been gone a long time. But
right.
He, to my knowledge, has never caught. They did have several formations and told us they were going to send the MPs in to search our lockers, and they didn't really want to do it because I think they were afraid what they're going to find.
Right.
Which would be the, you know, the drug aspect there, and they never did it. But I think they scared this guy enough that he at least stopped it somewhat.
How much effort was there to curb that drug use?
There was some, they planted some, or there were some guys who were snitches apparently. that caught some guys, and they got in trouble, and they got shipped out, and they lost their clearances, and it's that everybody has basic training. You turn into an infantryman when you get in trouble. So they got sent to the field as soldiers. I mean, you know,
wow.
Which is a bad thing to do.
Yeah.
It's a real, you know, step down. You're a lot more line of fire up, obviously, that way. And so when they got caught, they usually got sent to the field.
What do you think of the leadership in Vietnam? I guess your immediate supervisor, immediate commander, and then on up to the top.
Well, I thought my first tour they were good, but they transferred the officers about every 4 months, which I never could figure out. Like they're getting their ticket punched. They wanted to get their time in the unit or something.
Right.
I mean, in a year you could have three commanders. I thought it was ridiculous. We had good commanders, though, and good sergeants. Well, pretty good sergeants and good officers. The second tour, we didn't have very many officers around us. We were mostly in charge by the NCOs and a few lieutenants, but lieutenants were kind of idiots. In fact, the one that got almost got killed somehow, in a calamity of events, the second lieutenant became a first lieutenant and became in charge. I mean, I had more time in Vietnam than he had in the Army when he was in charge of us, and he was an idiot. He's the one that tried to frag after I left.
Okay.
And they weren't very effective. The second time, especially the last half of the second time, it seemed like the longer I was there, maybe my attitude, you know, going downhill too at the time. But they didn't seem like it was as good.
Okay. And as you spent time there, what did you think of the overall military commanders and the military policy of the United States in Vietnam?
Well, it was obvious we weren't trying to win anymore.
When did that become?
That was, I guess, during the second tour. I kind of got that idea that we were just treading water.
Okay.
Nobody's really trying anymore. He just didn't want to get killed, you know. But nobody was really trying anymore like they were at first. That gung-ho was gone. When you go to the field units, you saw more and more disenchantment. It seemed to switch. Let's see, I got back in September of 70s when I got back from my second tour, because I got out in September 71. So sometime in there in 70... Well, that's in April. From about April of 70 to about September of 70, it seemed like the whole thing just changed over there. And the demarcation or the line of dirt that I can associate with was when we went into Cambodia.
Okay.
It seemed like it changed everything.
What did you guys hear about that incursion?
Well, the ones that went over there that were in my unit, my unit went. I just wasn't there when it happened.
Okay.
They said, you know, it was a beautiful country, but they didn't say anything except they saw a few American units way out in the field that looked like, you know, they were been there for a long time. You couldn't even tell they were really soldiers except by the weapons. I mean, their hair was long, and they were just, you know, almost not rogues, but they said it was much, much different than what they were used to. These guys must have been some long-range troops that had been out there a long time. And they said it was much, much different.
Did your attitude of American policy overall change? You said when you first got there on your first tour, it was domino theory, stopping communist aggression. Did that evolve, change at all?
Well, I always thought that. In fact, when I was going back to my second tour, when a guy tried to pull me off a bus in Oakland, a hippie, a long-haired, stringy, white-haired, or kind of blondish, white-haired hippie tried to pull me off a bus. And I told him I'd volunteer to go back for a second tour. And he said, I hope you stay there.
Really? Where was this?
This was in Oakland.
In Oakland?
Yeah, we were getting on the buses to go out to the airport. This hippie was there, and of course, I was getting ready to punch him when the MP came up, and I explained to him what happened. He ran him off.
Right. Wow.
And off the base, whatever. He got him away from us.
Mm-hmm.
What was the question? I forgot where
the evolution in your mind of American
policy
and why you were there.
And so I was still, when I got back from my second tour, I was still there and wanted to be there, essentially. I really always have been kind of a patriotic, you know, American kind of guy.
Uh-huh.
But I could tell we weren't trying to win anymore, which bothered me, but I always thought we would win. I had no idea what was going to happen later. I couldn't see us. They weren't beating us, but we weren't winning either.
Right.
I think the problem was at the presidential level.
Okay.
I don't think they were trying in Washington. I don't think it was the commander's fault in the field. I don't think the politicians gave the war up or wouldn't allow it to be won.
Okay. You went over there during the Nixon administration, basically. Those are your two tours.
The first one was Johnson. The second was Nixon, yeah.
Okay. So, yeah, Nixon was in January 1969. Can you compare those two presidents? What was your attitude toward Johnson's policy and Nixon's policies?
Well, there wasn't a lot of change. You know, Nixon's actually the one that started withdrawal. I think Johnson micromanaged the war too much from Washington and made huge mistakes on how it should be fought. I think commanders in the field should be deciding what to blow up and not somebody in, you know, 13,000 miles away. You just can't, you know, run a war like that.
Okay.
Johnson and, well, and I guess Nixon did that to the same degree. He did, of course, I was long gone then. He did get pretty tough towards the end on the North Vietnamese, but I think they should have been bombing Haiphong Harbor at Hanoi from the very beginning and not doing the things, you know, that these special zones you had to fly through in order to bomb Hanoi and stuff. You know, the guys I met later who were in the Air Force, they said it was just murder on them. You know, it was just incredible what they were forced to do.
What did you think of the Vietnamization policy, turning the war over to the Vietnamese?
Well,
essentially turn it over to Arvin.
Yeah, basically turn it over to Arvin, you know. I didn't have a lot of strong knowledge or thoughts on it at the time. Of course, I was aware of it, and that's the reason we were slowly pulling out. You know, we'd have a unit be taken over by them, basically, as far as the duties, and they'd take it out, send the American troops home. But it didn't seem like it was working that well, but I wasn't that aware of it at the time. You know, again, I was young and just trying to get through my time there, but I didn't have a lot of strong feelings either way on it.
Okay. Were you, when you found out you were leaving, were you disappointed in a sense? I know you said you were happy to, or quote-unquote happy to be back there.
When I finished my second tour, I was ready to get out of the Army.
Okay.
I was sick of it. I could hardly stand it anymore.
Why?
I was very glad to be going home and being out of it. And in fact, I started getting worried going to the airport, you know, that last trip. I thought, good grief, this will be the time they get me. I remember for the first time in a long, long time, I actually got scared of driving down the highway.
Okay, I was going to ask you, were you ever scared over there?
Well, I got blown out of bed, you know, I was scared after the fact, and sniper rounds and stuff. Sometimes we were scared, yeah, but I think the scaredest I was, for some strange reason, was when I was leaving, thinking this is the time they're finally going to get me, you know.
Driving to the airport? Or?
Yeah, it was just kind of funny. It was fairly safe, but you never know.
Right. Did you fly out of Tonsonet?
I flew out of Tonsonet, yes.
Okay. What was that flight like for you? Was it all military, and were you in your uniform? And
yeah, it was all military. We were all in uniform. You know, we had to be.
Uh-huh.
And it was just great to be going home with. I finally had my FTA, my flight to America.
Okay.
Go back to the land of round eyes, and which was American women.
Uh-huh.
And it was great. We were ready to go. Flight to America. We also used that as, you know, also, you say, you know, fuck the Army with that, too. You know, the FTA meant two things for us.
Right.
We were getting out of the Army, and we had our flight to America.
Right, right. So did you fly back into Oakland?
Yeah, flew back to Oakland. That was the most amazing thing. Within about 72 hours of being in there, you know, I was a sergeant and fairly in charge of what I was doing.
Uh-huh.
Within 72 hours of being in Vietnam, I was in my mother's kitchen, El Red, Arkansas.
That is incredible.
That's a cultural shock.
What was that like for you?
Well, I didn't know what to think. It was just like I went to sleep and woke up in two different worlds.
Right.
The processing and everything was done real quickly, and we just turned everything in, and they run us through a physical. It wasn't a physical. We just signed our paper saying we were okay. They never tested anything, really, except our ears a little bit. And when I got home, I didn't know what to do. I had a whole bunch of money on me at the time. It was like $1,100, seemed like a lot of money. It was all in 50s. I had 22 50s on me, remember that. It was back pay and everything. We even had some guys that doctored our records to make sure we got more money when we got out.
Okay.
We knew people in personnel. We just extend the number of days you had coming and leave.
Right.
If you had six, they'd make it 36 or something like that.
Okay.
And so we gave ourselves a little severance pay that way.
Okay.
Actually, I didn't do that, but the guys that knew me did it for me and some others of us.
Okay.
And when I got home, I just stayed in the house for a couple of weeks. I didn't know what to do.
What?
I mean, colors especially kind of blew my mind.
I'm sorry? Colors?
Colors. I mean, I wasn't used to seeing anything but brown and green. I mean, everything was either brown or green. The ground was brown, and we were wearing green, and everything was green or brown.
Right.
And the Vietnamese had some colors on them, of course, especially the women. They had their long, you know, things they wore, and they had some colors, but it was like going from black and white to color.
Huh. And what was the reaction when you, I guess you landed there in Oakland, you're still around the military personnel. What was your first experience with civilians when you got back from the second tour?
Well, I don't remember my first. I remember my first big encounter when we got, well, it was a civilian. Okay, when we left Oakland there, we caught a, you know, taxi into town to get on. We had, you know, orders. To, I mean, we had whatever it was, our tickets or something. And four or five of us got a taxi into the terminal.
Right.
And it was, you know, wasn't, I don't know how far it was. And the guy said it was going to be so much per head, and I said, well, like $10 per head, I thought it was kind of high. I said, well, turn the meter on. And he said, okay. And he turned his meter on and got there, so like in $8 or $9 on that.
Uh-huh.
And he wanted like, you know, $10 a piece from us, which I knew was a ripoff.
Right.
So he said, I'll call the police. I said, that's fine. I said, I've been ripped off, you know, from cab drivers for the last 2 years. It's not going to happen here.
Right.
I said, I'll find one for you. So I called a policeman over.
Right.
And the guy took off.
Okay.
We told him what happened, and they... Again, I'd written down all this stuff on a little card there when I was in the back seat. So I gave them all the information. They were pretty pissed, the guy.
Okay.
Trying to steal from, you know, soldiers coming back, basically what they were doing.
Right. So you caught a flight out of San Francisco and back to Arkansas?
Back to Little Rock.
Okay. And what was the reception like when you got home?
Well, my parents were glad to see me, but I mean, there wasn't any parades or anything. you just show up, you've been gone, now you're back. I mean, it was weird.
I can only imagine it was so different for Vietnam veterans versus World War II veterans.
It was just, and the war was going on. I mean, it was
uh-huh.
the 10-year deal, and I was there for 2 years. You just got home and you were back.
Right.
All your friends were there, and they were doing the same thing. You know, most of them hadn't been anywhere anyway, except going to college or whatever.
Right.
Or working. It was kind of strange.
Well, what did your friends say? I mean, did any of them go to Vietnam? Or?
Well, you know, it just kind of like it didn't happen much. Nobody asked me a whole lot about it. Some, you know, and they knew I'd been there and that, but it was no big deal, really. Just another guy came back. It was like a non-event, really.
Really? And what did you, when you saw the news at night and the war was continuing after you left, just for a few more years for the Americans, what were your feelings on that?
Well, you kind of turned off somewhat. I would watch it, though. I was shocked when Saigon fell, though. I mean, I was shocked and outraged over that. But during the other times, I just kind of watched it. I could see that we were winding down and pulling almost, by 72, we had almost everybody out of there anyway.
Right.
I think the 82nd was when the last units leave up in Da Nang. But I don't know, nothing you could do about it. You just tried to live your life, and I was going to school on my GI Bill, and I just didn't think about that much.
Okay, and nobody really questioned you too much about it?
Not a lot. There was still protesting going on, but I didn't care. You know, I was studying at the time and using my GI Bill and
right.
working another job, loading freight at a freight company, and you just go about my life, you know,
mm-hmm.
just trying to make up for lost time.
Was it a relatively easy transition for you overall, or difficult?
Well, I think it's more difficult than I realize. And I talked to another guy, like none of us really totally got maybe straightened out over the deal sometimes. I think it lingers with you a long time, probably forever. It's just such an unusual experience, and it comes back a lot. You know, I can still hear helicopters and think about Vietnam.
Really?
Oh, yeah. The first thing I think of is the coppers were always flying over. You always were hearing helicopters, so that immediately just like going straight back.
Right.
And when I run into other veterans, and we tend to talk about this way too much, it seems like, in bars and, you know,
mm-hmm.
over beer and this and that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure everybody else gets sick of hearing it. I get sick of hearing it sometimes, but I still can't stop not talking about it or answering questions or whatever.
Right. Well, it was a significant, you know, event in your life.
Yeah, that's it. No question. But, no question.
Yeah. One question about I want to ask about your experience in country in Vietnam. How about Agent Orange or any other defoliants? Have you contact
Agent Orange.
With that?
Yeah. I've got some problems with that now, I think. I've got a swollen left hand that I've had since I got back, and I've had my left hip replaced when I was 39 for some unknown reason. It just died. It was called an infarct, which is like when you have a heart attack, the vein shuts down. So there's one vein that feeds your hip, and the ball, and if it shuts down for any reason, then your ball, your left ball eventually dies. It starts flaking off, and then your hip jams up, and they got to go into a replacement. So at 39, I had that done.
Okay.
Pretty unusual. Wasn't any car wrecks or anything. I don't know what caused it. I think it was Agent Orange. My swollen left hand I'm looking at right now as I'm talking to you is the same thing. It's been like that ever since. I think I drank some Agent Orange mixed in Kool-Aid at one of these units I was with, one of these fire support bases. They a lot of times would use Agent Orange as a defoliant, what they called Indian pumps. They would spray it out like any kind of a pump would. It's a herbicide anyway, and they would spray it out in the course around their fire support base to kill all the foliage where the bad guys couldn't get close to them. You know, they
right.
could see them coming and then shoot them.
Right.
And it would drift back and get in the water supply. And apparently they just put Kool-Aid in to kill the taste.
Really?
And I didn't know that until I had been out to some of these places, and I'm sure I drank some.
So you think that's where your main contact?
I think that's where my main contact was. It was getting it inadvertently in mixed in the water supply.
Okay. Have you talked to any other veterans who've experienced similar symptoms?
Some of them have Agent Orange deal. Everybody's got some of them had it spilled on them when they're in the field. Different things. You know, I've gone to the VA about it. They basically denied it completely, but I think there's a definite correlation there. That's the only place I know that I got it, but you never know.
Okay. Looking back now at America's experience in Vietnam, what is your opinion of the policy that that the United States had over there?
Well, the policy was probably good to help, you know, people, you know, have their own self-determination. I have no problem with the altruistic reason behind it, which is hopefully what it was. The way it was carried out, though, I think was incredibly stupid. I mean, you don't fight a war with one hand tied behind your back. I think Colin Powell and Schwarzkopf's conduct in the Persian Gulf War shows you with an overwhelming force, it's better for you and the bad guys. If you just wipe them out off at the very beginning, then it's over, and that's the end of the story. Of course, Vietnam was a different geography with a forest versus the desert they had in Desert Storm. But I think overwhelming force is the way to fight a war. If you're going to do it, I mean, get over with.
Okay.
I mean, war is not good. The longer it lasts, the worse it is for everybody. Environment, people, everything.
Okay. You think the United States could have won the war, could have definitely changed what had happened if it had fought that way?
Yeah, I think they could have won it, yeah.
Okay.
No question.
Okay. You said you were outraged and shocked at the fall of Saigon in 1975 in April.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Well, I mean, I've been in the embassy there. I've been all over Saigon. I knew it real well. I was watching everybody, you know, leaving, scurrying around like a bunch of rats leaving a sinking ship, which is exactly what it was. The helicopters landing at sea and then pushing them off the carriers and make room for them to land.
Right.
Just a mad dash for freedom by the Vietnamese, having to almost shoot them and, you know, kick them with the, you know, butts of your rifle to keep them, you know, getting aboard.
Right.
I thought it was a terrible disgrace, the way that it was done. I mean, it looked like after 10 years that had a better contingency plan than that to get out there in case things went wrong.
Right.
I mean, how could you not have a better plan than that?
Right.
They were apparently caught totally flat-footed and didn't know what was coming on. It must have been a breakdown in intel somewhere. I mean, it's just ridiculous. The Vietnamese army collapsed in Pleiku coup, and they never recovered. I mean, they were gone. It seemed to happen when they lost the B-52 bombing strikes, which partly was, you know, Nixon's problem with Watergate then. He kind of lost interest, I think, in Vietnam. And when we stopped really giving them the air support, which is the linchpin, I mean, to keep the Vietnamese Army going, the South Vietnamese Army going, when they lost the air support, that was pretty much it. They just couldn't stand up to the North Vietnamese.
What kind of lessons can the United States learn from this? You mentioned some earlier when you were talking about fighting
can't fight a war half-assed. That's just not the way to do it. I mean, you don't do that way. If you were in a fight protecting your wife or your child, you wouldn't have one hand behind your back.
Right.
If you protect your country, why do this? Why do that? I mean, it's ridiculous what was carried out.
Did the war change your perceptions of the United States government, any?
Yeah, I guess I saw it. It wasn't a big Superman deal like when you're growing up. You think it's, you know, got the answer to every problem in the world. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we're just as human and as fallible as any other people. We have a rule of law, though, versus a rule of people, which I've learned to respect a great deal than our uniqueness in that respect. So I guess it made me more of a realist. It took off the rose-covered glasses.
Okay. Do you think Vietnam still haunts the government today? You hear this talk about the quote-unquote Vietnam syndrome, and it's affecting our efforts today in this war on terrorism and our efforts in Afghanistan and now Iraq. Do you think Vietnam's still with us?
I guess it'll always be with us somewhat, just like, you know, the Civil War, World War II, or anything else, it'll be always with us to some degree. I think the lessons are what we should remember. I think we do have a big problem now about taking any casualties, I think, which is inevitable sometimes. I think presidents and the public, especially whoever's not in power, tends to play this as some kind of big, almost like a race card or something, about the casualty specter. There's going to be casualties, but I mean, sometimes the war has to be fought. I mean, 9/11 taught us a lot of things, I think.
Yeah.
Or hopefully it did. I think a lot of people have forgotten it already. You can't cave in to evil. I mean, you just can't.
Yes, sir.
All it takes for, what that said long ago, for evil overcome us, for good men do nothing.
Yes, sir.
And unfortunately, that's true. It's not a nice world we live in sometimes.
Have you had any contact with Vietnamese here in America?
Not really. There's some around, you know, everywhere, but I haven't really had any contact with them per se. Maybe in restaurants and things like that, I've seen some, but
right.
None in particular.
How do you feel about Vietnam today, the country?
Well, obviously, we have a better policy than we do with Cuba. We're trading with Vietnam, which is remarkable after we fought a war with them like that, and we're not trading with Cuba, which is a lot closer.
Right.
I think we have a very realistic policy probably towards it, and I think the Vietnamese people have probably forgotten the war more than we have. I understand that the average age over there is like two-thirds of the country is under 40 or something like that.
You're right. It's almost like 80% under the age of 30.
I mean, it's not really even that communistic anymore. If it wasn't for the old guard in charge, they'd probably be a free democracy now. All they want to do is have fun. I mean, Saigon, people in Saigon, they were pretty westernized by us and the French before. I think that stays with them, especially when you got a younger generation. They don't care much about ideology. They do freedom, and they want to have a good time listening to CDs and, ride their mopeds or whatever. And I think humans are pretty much all alike anywhere. Once you're given the chance and have a rule of law, that they're going to basically go about and do the same things we do.
Right. What do you think the attitude of the American public is now toward Vietnam, especially the younger generations who really, don't have a lot of idea about what happened in Vietnam?
Well, I've got a 15-year-old daughter, and we've talked about it some, but, of course, she's not really quite old enough yet to even have some opinions, I don't think, about
right.
that. She may be this year. She's in the 10th grade. But most of them, it's like World War II. It's a distant past. In fact, I'm amazed sometimes to think that I've been out of Vietnam longer than my father was out of World War II when I went to Vietnam.
Hmm.
That's a big jump, really, in my mind when I think about that. Hmm. I also realize it reminds me how old I am. But I think that it's just a distant memory for a lot of people, except those ones that are, maybe 45 or above, or 40 above anyway.
Yes, sir. How do you feel about your service in Vietnam today?
I'm real glad that I joined and did what I did. I mean, it's been, like you said, a big experience, and it's been a shaping one, both good and bad probably, but I'm very glad that I went and did my part. I wasn't a hero, but I showed up. And I think that was important.
No regrets?
No regrets, no.
Okay. Let me ask you about the media coverage of the war. There's been a lot of controversy about that.
Yes.
What's your opinion on that?
Well, I think the media obviously had a bias and had an axe or a hidden agenda somewhat, at least subconsciously, if not consciously. I think the longer it went on, I think the media pretty much has, like politicians, they have their finger in the air about which way things are going, and they tend to support what seems popular. I think since the protests or that part of the war in the United States looked like it was the majority opinion, at least it was the loudest opinion, but it was the majority not, it was definitely, loud. I think the media supported what they thought was what people wanted to see.
Okay.
I think they really kind of did a disservice by not being a little more unbiased.
Okay. How about today, books on Vietnam? Have you come across any books, or do you read about Vietnam, or do you try to read the history books about it, or the popular?
I'll read some of that. I've got some friends that give me books all the time on this. I have a guy that gets free books. He reads for the local paper, and he gets his books all the time, and I've had several of those. I prefer really to read about World War II, the Civil War, though, mm-hmm. since I was in Vietnam. It's not something I need to know more about, really. Especially moving around like I did, I got a much better view than the average soldier did over there.
Right.
And I don't like to watch on TV that much, really. I do sometimes, but I don't really like it as much. I'd rather watch about another war, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it does. What about Vietnam movies, like When We Were Soldiers?
Well, that was pretty good, yeah. Mel Gibson deal, I thought that was pretty good. That was pretty poignant at the end there when the North Vietnamese officers said that, this now America will think they can win this.
Mm-hmm.
And all it's going to happen, more people are going to get killed on both sides. I thought it was pretty well done, though, and I think it really shows how the basic soldier did his job.
Mm-hmm.
And that the politicians really didn't make the commitment, and therefore we either shouldn't have been there or we should have gone in and won it in a couple of years.
Okay. Any other movies that you think are worthwhile for people to watch to learn about Vietnam?
Well, there's not very many of them. John Wayne's Green Berets on there, which is something out like a World War II kind of movie, basically. Though it does show pretty well some of the aspects, like the Puff Magic, the dragon that comes over and, wipes the entire NVA unit. After they take their objective, they all get killed.
Mm-hmm.
It shows the awesome firepower of it. I mean, the firepower over is incredible. I mean, it's just incredible.
Yeah.
I think those things are educational. As far as the whys, and I don't think you get me from any of that out of that. I think all you really get is just what the average soldier went through.
Okay.
Which is good, but it doesn't get the political reasons.
How about movies like Apocalypse Now?
I thought that was I saw that and I couldn't believe it. I mean, that's the most unreal movie I've ever seen in my life.
Okay.
I can't. It didn't respond to anything in Vietnam that I knew. And I moved around a lot. I was in a lot of different places.
Right.
I had a top secret clearance. I was privy to some things the average guys didn't see. And I thought that was, you know, a kind of a surreal movie, really.
Okay.
I can't imagine anything like that ever being true. It could be, though. But
yeah. What about Platoon, Oliver Stone's Platoon?
Platoon, I thought, was pretty good. That was, again, back to the, you know, what the average grunt goes through.
Mm-hmm.
Well, except for the situation, that was Steel Metal Jacket. Platoon, I thought, was pretty good. I thought Platoon was pretty good, especially since he'd been there. He had a perspective on that. I thought Platoon was pretty good. And the Steel Metal Jacket, I thought the soldier getting killed during basic training was pretty unusual, and shooting the sergeant and blowing his own head off.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was ridiculous, but it doesn't happen.
Nothing like that.
No, it's too strict, and you're too scared, and you're not that crazy. That guy just, you know, he was a mental case. I mean, you don't get that crazy.
Right. What about the second half of Full Metal Jacket, the Battle of Wei and all that?
The Battle of Wei, I wasn't there. I knew some guys that were. That looked pretty real. I can imagine those guys thinking that this is the way they always thought war was going to be. With, you know, they're running at them, and they're mowing them down, which is a nice place to be in a strong defensive position. That's the way you want to fight a war if you can.
Mm-hmm.
I can see that. That makes sense.
How about music when you were there? Did that play a big role in your experience in Vietnam?
Music?
Uh-huh. Yes, sir.
Yeah, we listened to music all the time. A lot of guys had these big reel-to-reel, which were popular in those days, recorders,
mm-hmm.
that they would get from the PASEC, the Pacific Exchange. We listened to music all the time, a lot of protest songs. We would, you know, drink beer, smoke doobies,
mm-hmm.
and listen to it all the time. It was a big part of it, especially when we get during the second tour when we had less to do.
Mm-hmm.
We'd sit around at night and listen to music a lot.
Okay. Any songs remind you, any particular songs, or musical groups that remind you of your time in Vietnam?
Well, I remember Santana a lot. He was real popular, real good. Still like Santana. The Vietnamese used to, I always remember that these had Vietnamese groups too that came around and played. Of course, they tried to speak English, but with a little bit of an accent, and I always remember just Galveston. You know, I used to find my chair laughing at that, you know.
Right.
They knew where Galveston was, much less, you know, what was going on. But it was, I remember that. Every time I hear that song, I smile a little bit. And of course, all the protest songs of that era, you know. What are we fighting for? Don't give a damn, next stop to Vietnam. You know, all of those went through all the Woodstock type, you know, era.
Joe McDonald.
Yeah. I remember Santana a lot, though. We listened to Santana a lot.
Okay. No particular song, like, comes on the radio today? Do you think of Vietnam? Or maybe, like, Oh, Yeah, Come Over or something by Santana?
Well, yeah, that. Of course, Galveston, I mentioned.
Uh-huh.
And what's that song, The Ode to the Devil, Pleased to Meet You, Guess My Name?
Sympathy for the Devil, by
the way. Yeah, you know, Ode to the Devil, I think. It goes to Pleased to Meet You, Hope You Guess My Name.
Sympathy for the Devil.
Yeah, Sympathy to the Devil. Yeah, I remember hearing that a lot, too,
yes,
which is, for some sales seemed pretty poignant at the time.
Uh-huh. Well,
and some of the guys into music more than I was. They were the ones who had recorders, and they had all kinds of stuff, and they could talk for hours about it, and I would just listen to what they had on most of the time.
Right.
But it was a big deal with your soldiers in general. They used the music was a big stressor, I guess, releaser.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else that you want to add or what you would like to talk about regarding your time in Vietnam or your time after or anything today?
Nothing I can probably think of offhand. Other than it was, you know, it was a big deal. I remember it well. And it seems like it's a specter that haunts. I guess everybody went to Vietnam because of the way it turned out and the way we were treated. But nothing in particular I can think of offhand.
Okay.
Probably won't hang the phone up, I will, but right now I can't.
You can always call us back. Okay. Well, this will end our oral history interview with Douglas Shivers. Mr. Shivers, thank you very much for your participation, and thanks for answering all the questions and being open with us.
I appreciate it.
Yes, sir. This is Richard Verone. We're going to continue with one more session with Mr. Shivers. Mr. Shivers, we were talking after we had paused the recording, and you were telling me about another incident that you wanted to get down. What was that?
Yeah, in regard to going downtown and going to Saigon and things like that,
yes,
I remember that we were in a military intelligence unit. So we had classified travel orders in many cases to go anywhere we wanted to. Right below combat essential, we were like number two on the list to get on planes or whatever.
Right.
A lot of times we'll go to Saigon for illegal purposes somewhat, and we had orders already typed up that showed we could go anywhere we wanted to, basically.
Really?
They were everything. It stopped. It always made the MPs give you orders back and say, go ahead. But... And this is true. I mean, this is a true story.
You guys would type up the false orders just
We had the false orders typed up because we had the forms already there.
Uh-huh.
We just changed the date on them occasionally. And
right.
Other than that, we had them. But we had them, the signature blocks is what the key was on this.
Right.
We had two of them. We had one of them signed by Captain Don E. Duck. True story. And the other one was signed by Major Mike E. Mouse.
Oh, boy.
And I had been stopped many times in Saigon when I wasn't supposed to be there, and I presented these orders with a little smirk on my face,
uh-huh.
and they would look at them. They never looked at the signature block. They never looked at the signature block.
Wow.
It would say, you know, combat essential or top secret, do not delay, classified, all this language was in there.
Uh-huh.
But it was signed by Captain Don E. Duck and Major Mikey Mouse, and it worked every blooming time.
Wow. Okay. So you'd use this basically to go to Saigon to spend, a couple of days off?
Well, we'd go down there either to get some stuff to smoke or to get some girls.
Okay.
And we had our own trucks. We basically had signed out to ourselves on a permanent basis, so we had our own trucks.
Uh-huh.
I had one that I drove all the time. It was 1947, something or other, but it worked.
Okay.
And it's like a personal vehicle.
Right.
My personal vehicle.
Right. Okay. Okay, anything else, sir?
That's all I can think of offhand here.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
All right.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
Sure.